Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Show Talk with Angela Butler. The interview today is with civil rights activist Polya Lafayette-Clark. Ms. Clark was a student at Tupelo College in Mississippi. She was one of the students to try to integrate a white a library, get a library built. She also was lead assistant to civil rights leader Meckner Evers. Also, she ran for state senate in New York in 2010, the Green Bay Party. All right, Ms. Would you like to talk about what happened? What happened with the Levi that flooded 1927? Can we start with that?
Yeah, the levee, 1927, the flood, the great flood of 1927, which is much larger than that flood of at New Orleans, the Katrina and Rita floods that we have in recent times. Before I start, I want to make sure that I was not one of the students that desegregated the library at Jackson, the sit-in there, the famous sit-in, the Black Tuesday sit-in. I was worked on that project from 59 forward, but did not participate in 61, which was Mississippi's first major sit-in. I was in an exam and couldn't make it. And I just want to be clear that I'm Mississippi and I'm Alabama. I'm the person who is one of the co-founders of the Selma Project at Black Belt Project at Alabama. Not only that, my first husband and I are also the founders of SNCC's major project for Alabama, and that's 63 prior to Dr. King in 65. And he came in at the end of 65 after we, after he left the project. So I want to be clear about that. Now, the thing that I want to say that I think is very, very important about that levy of 1927 is that we're talking about that used to be recorded as the major flood in the United States of America. It was an interesting flood in that the water actually backed up from the Gulf of Mexico through the Atchafalaya Basin there in New Orleans area, all the way to Cairo, Illinois. It had a back up water. It flooded lands, including all the Delta flatlands, all the way to Cairo. But also, it was a flood that talked about the judicial and state violence in the United States of America. Well, we can see that judicial violence. My father, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, and maternal great-grandfather were among the hundreds of upon hundreds of black men that were forced to serve on the work on the levee. There was an order that went out that every black man within 150 miles of that levee had to show. They didn't put in an age on it. You had to show. So if you lived in 150 miles of the levee, you had to show to work on it. The water was breaking, and obviously there was death and violence all around. Levees were being blown up because whites were blowing up the levee if you were upstream. It flooded the downstream. The wars among planters, and so we could talk about the planters' wars, and went all the way to New Orleans, Louisiana. It was a war of violence like none other in terms of just the white violence. But the violence on black people, with husbands and fathers being forced to come and sons being forced to come and work on the levees, black women were not allowed to leave the little shanties that they lived in the Mississippi Delta, and that flatland, which is now way, way above. The water's just way over the little houses and up onto the tin-top roofs. And my father talks about the tin-top roofs. So if you can begin to imagine this kind of violence, and he would describe it as riding along on these little rafts. And did you say something, Angela?
Yes.
And as you travel on the rafts, you see the black women and children on top of these little tin roofs holding on for dear life, along with snakes and panthers and pigs and cows. Everything was fighting for its own life, and as my father put it, fighting for its own space, so that surfers weren't striking at people. They were just coiled up and watching and waiting, and cows were, trying to hold on to the top of the roof, and panthers had that little space. Everybody had this little space, and black mama and her babies were sitting there with black mama with her little stick and whatever she could find to try to keep her kids alive. Bodies were coming around them left and right. People were holding on to logs. The waters are just loaded down with people. But white women and children are being taken out by the United States government via rafts and whatever they could get to get them out. And the law was that black women and children were not to be allowed to leave the plantation. So those who got out on their own, as we did during the Civil War, the Great Civil War, that it's come into this same area where black women and children made it to the Union lines, fighting on their own to be abused and disrespected by the Union Army once they got there. So this was the flood of 1927. It really is the greatest flood in the history of the United States. It went all the way around back up to the Delaware area because, you know, we live on that southern Gulf Stream. So that Gulf Stream also went up the east coast of the United States. But it laid there, that flood laid there for over right at 300 days.
Yes, ma'am.
Yet the government said we only lost, I think, 1,050 people or something.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you get the picture out of there? You get my picture. This is Buddy Violence, like we can't even do, but I can sing to it, you know, because the famous blues, that water rising, baby, that water rising and deepening as it comes. So, you know, we got all the music that comes with that, but the violence and the violence of the levee camps, all of that would be a part of the history of my growing up in my household, as my grandparent and parent talked about 1927, 13 years before I was born.
All right. So it's worse than what happened in New Orleans then.
I think far worse than the New Orleans flood. The New Orleans flood didn't hang that long. See, when a flood hangs, you got about a flood that's hanging hundreds or more days? No, you're talking about deadly violence. Mother Nature was not being kind, not at all. And you're talking about flat land in the desert, in the Delta. Delta's flat land. It's absolutely flat. And because the planters have come in here and taken away the trees to plant massive cotton and soybeans and rice and whatever they're planting, and then they usually plant right up to the river. That's why now the Mississippi River is in such a danger because, well, the good part of the reason is that you plant right up to the river. So they're using these poisons, and they're poisoning the river. You walk along the riverbanks, and you just see dead fish everywhere. Turtles will see up hundreds of years flat on their backs.
Oh, my goodness.
So if you can imagine that and imagine a people with nothing. Black people had literally nothing.
Yes,
you own these classless lands.
My grandparents talked
about
it. And
now you got the great flood.
Yes, ma'am. So, Ms. Clark, you've worked with just, you know, in the introduction I was saying that you tried to integrate a library, and also that you were lead assistant to the great civil rights leader, Medgar Evers. Would you like to talk about any of that?
Well, let's talk about it. 1959, I entered college. It was a very interesting period in history because the Korean War is winding down, and the Korean soldiers are coming home. And at the same time, around the country, you've had several great events that have the momentous events that have taken place. We got Montgomery 55-56, the Montgomery bus boycott. You got the initiation in 57 of the first U.S. Civil Rights Commission in the history of the country with no powers except to investigate it. You got at the same time Dr. King's group, SCLC, being formed in New Orleans, Louisiana, with Sister Ella J. Baker, who would later be thrown out as their first executive director. You got, by now, 59, you got the young people over in Arkansas who have desegregated the schools in Arkansas, and the major Arkansas crisis with the President of the United States ordering in federal marshals, not federal troops, to assure the safety of the children and that they can desegregate the schools. So you got these momentous events taking place. And you got the last major lynching in the history of the United States, Mass Charles Park, a popular bill, Mississippi. And they call it the mass. We know it's not the last major, but it's the last popularized one in the history of the nation.
Okay.
So all those things are happening. And Ghana and Africa has become independent. And Africa is having an uprising. Got a man named Jomo Kenyatta who's been said to be on his way to be released from jail. And he's talking about Mau Mau and, oh, my God, free the land movements are happening. You got everything going on. And then there's, I go to college. It's 1959. I enter college, and in the very first month of my arrival, a group of us got together and formed the first NAACP chapter in the college chapter in the state of Mississippi. Our job, we were to focus on ways of desegregating at that time our facilities in Mississippi. Now, this is prior to the sit-in, just 4 months prior to the sit-in. 5 months, really, because that's when the sit-ins will take place in February the following year. So we did form that chapter, and we were beginning to talk about how do we take Mississippi to task? How do we desegregate Mississippi? How do we make some fundamental changes in Mississippi that will be lasting changes that will kind of open up at least a little door, a little crack in the door of that great wall of hopelessness that the state had around it. So that is what our job was. And we do that. We began that, and Meggie Evers comes out, Meggie Whitey Evers, who was state field secretary for NHP for the state of Mississippi. And he comes out, he works with us, but he's not alone because our dean, Mangrum at the college, was with us, and the dean from a little school called Campbell College, Methodist College, that was in the city. We outside the city. Tougaloo College, known as the Oasis of the South, which will house the civil rights movement eventually, was located outside of the city of Jackson, city limits.
Okay.
But inside of the city limits was Campbell College, and these students came over. And then Jackson State had a little budding on its campus, Jackson State College at that time. It had been formerly a Baptist school, but now had been taken over by the state, so it was a state college. They had a little budding on that campus as well. But I didn't see that budding. I wouldn't see that budding until the day of the great sit-in. So we start there. We start there talking about how we move on Mississippi. We would make phone calls to radio stations, phone calls to popular whites, threatening to tell them we were going to be coming to do this and that, and then the sit-ins actually started in Carolina. We were not a part of that, made a sit-in. Mississippi would not be a part of the sit-in movement until March of 1961.
We planned a test case, and it was a test case,
and that test case would be at the Jackson Public Library. So that test case was pulled off, and it was pulled off followed by ugly violence, the introduction of dogs to the civil rights movement, with a famous photographer from Jet Magazine, Alexander Ben. You see him with a dog at his throat, and the dog actually jumping on and biting young men. So Jackson, Mississippi introduced dogs to the movement. They already had police, billy clubs, and all the rest, but now we had dogs. They already had fire hoses, but now we had dogs. So we had another story. We had Khrushchev even sending a cablegram, get the dogs off my children. If you can imagine politics of peace, so-called peace, and then we entered this age of the Cold War. So Khrushchev stepped it up one, get the dogs off his children. So we became his children over in Mississippi. So we got everything moving. We have this dynamic period, and that's a part of where I started with the civil rights movement. Prior to that, I formed the Jackson History Club for girls only, because, you know, we were separated, really, in Mississippi, girls and boys. Boys went one way, girls went the other. And so I tried to get girls into a reading club. That had failed. But that same model that I would use for Selma, Alabama, was a model that I would use to form the Jackson, the North Jackson NHP Youth Council, which is an outgrowth of this piece at Tougaloo. I will move from there to actually founding an NHP North Jackson Youth Council in my own community. And this will be the youth council that will work with Medieva to kick off the historic civil rights movement of 1963, followed by his immediate death.
So the students did a lot.
When I say me, I'm talking about all of the young people that I work with. I'm talking about the elders who risked their businesses to sponsor us. There was a group of, there was two people who have always, all of us, who had wonderful grocery store, kind of pool hall or something on the side, but it was the first time we had a major grocery store in a black community in the North Jackson, where I am. And now North Jackson is different from West Jackson or downtown Jackson, the Jackson area where Mint Street is, where Jackson State University is. We were, first of all, where most of the free slaves in Mississippi had lived. This is the area where most of them lived. None of them lived outside of Jackson, and Mississippi didn't have but 555 free Africans during the period of slavery, 555, and they all lived in Jackson area, most of them in the North Jackson area. We were outside of the city limits initially. We were what was called the subdivisions. North, you have the suburbs. Down south, you get the subdivisions. So we were in the subdivision. But we also did not go to regular schools. We didn't have regular county schools. Our schools were part of the Rosenwald Fund-sponsored schools, where they actually Rosenwald would put up the money for the buildings. Black folk would get, usually try to get white contractors, but many black contractors also helped to build the buildings. Now, my first school was New Hope in this same Rosenwald zone, but it had been built right after the Civil War by former slaves, and I can never forget this tall black brother who would come in the morning to stoke the fireplace, you know, and not in the fireplace, but the little ovens, the coal stoves, and the two big rooms that we housed in. The small room had to live off the heat from the two other rooms.
Yes, ma'am.
So this is where I started.
I
So I've been on this journey a long time, working with others, not by myself. This has not been a journey alone, working with other young people, plotting together, scheming together, doing whatever we had to do, but also being there with Medgar Rodney Evans, who would eventually ask me to become the special assistant for the state of Mississippi.
Oh, yes.
That was my role.
And what was it like working
by the
with
Jackson, NHP Youth Branch to be a special assistant to Medgar Rodney Evans.
Man, what was it like working with the great civil rights leader, Medgar Evers?
I worked with so many great civil rights leaders, so let me see. It was wonderful.
Okay.
It was, for me, a little young girl, because I was in my early 20s, just entering 20. It was a time of learning and a time of listening. And a time, I mean, this is great excitement. I was enchanted by the way, I called him Harry Truman. Because Medgar would get in the car, he'd drive in the town, the lights would go out, he'd go by, you see lights go off on porches, you can't turn around, lights were going back on. You see windows go up and down, shades, you know, whatever. That meant that he was coming through. Medgar was coming through. And he was going to park somewhere, but you had to figure out a way not to get the cops there before you could make them, you know, get your job done. And you knew, he knew, and I learned immediately that the average black was scared to death, and many of these average blacks would call the sheriff or the police. You'd be shocked that you could be somewhere getting ready to talk with someone. You just drove up, and you didn't even see a telephone line. And all of a sudden, there was cops, sheriffs, and his buddies. And you'd be like, how did they get there so fast? So black people would run across fields or whatever they could to report you. So I learned that from Medgar. I learned from Medgar that there was value in listening. Just listening to people. Oftentimes saying nothing. But you learn to listen. I learned from Medgar how to move strategically to build anything. And a part of what I learned was what you'll see in my model. I had, that was also part of the concept that I was developing, because I did housing and logistics for two regional conferences that were meeting in Mississippi. And we're bringing all these greats, you know, Harry Belafonte, Jackie Robinson, everybody was coming to Mississippi. I never forget February 62, not only did the great Jackie Robinson, those come, but we had Floyd Patterson, who was up for a boxing match. And, you know, we had the great, the heavyweight champion of the world come. He was a soft-spoken man who said very little, but, you know, he was at the airport. And my favorite, Archie Moore, who had just been stripped of his championship. Archie would say, a man's championship can only be won or lost in the ring. So you had this, we had Kurt Flood, who was on his way to becoming the baseball great in terms of organizing baseball players. So all of these people are coming to Mississippi, but a few women, too.
All right.
So, you know,
that's great. So,
with the great
Clark,
some
I know
great men and women.
I'm going to ask, not trying to be disrespectful or interrupt you, but the movie Selma, what is your opinion of the movie Selma?
Well, the Huffington Post, if you go online, you'll discover that it was a nice article that they did. They found me somewhere. Oh, Selma, I thought, you know, as a film, a piece of art, is a very good piece of art. But as a piece of history, as a value truth-telling piece of history that young people can use to build from, is a sad state of affairs. To spend hundreds of millions of dollars building a film on a town that is absolutely rotten and deteriorating is a disgrace. And as far as I'm concerned, a sin and a crime against humanity. Those are the things that I think are important to note. So I'm a little worried about Selma in that sense. But all the uproar around Selma, the players in Selma, half of them were not there when they were supposed to be there. Dr. King did not come to Selma from Albany, Georgia. Dr. King came to Selma from St. Augustine, Florida, the oldest city in the United States and the oldest slavery in the United States, 1572. So building the lie so that you could downplay the difference between mobilization and organization. Dr. King mobilized. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which hit the ground there in 1963, February of 63, came in to organize. Selma was organized and had mass demonstrations and was in the process of continuing demonstrations when Dr. King arrives. You got to get my point. Okay?
Yes, ma'am.
So what we have is, and when you see this film that's projecting this now with Dr. King driving around with John in a car, but I always focus on the violence against youth, the violence against Stokely Carmichael, a.k.a. Kwame Ture, the founder of the Black Power Movement, the violence against James Forman, the executive director of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, is just unacceptable. The violence against SNCC is unacceptable. The violence against the youth who organized with us, Charles Bonner, who's working with me now on a symposium on judicial violence, judicial and state violence at Princeton University, pulled off for Juneteenth of next year. That young man was with us at the start, just a young boy. We were young, too. We were just in our early 20s when Bernard and I hit the ground in Selma. We were 22.
Yes,
all right?
Yes.
So we were kids, but we were kids who by now had Bernard and I nothing but experience because we'd been on the battlefield. But we came in, and within minutes, we organized those young people to Selma because they were waiting for something to do, something that would change their lives, as I had been in the late 50s when I was trying to organize young black girls in Jackson, something that would change their lives. And so they moved immediately, expediently, and organized the town, and they had it by 1963, the December, they had 530 people in jail in Selma.
Oh, my goodness. Like it is now, they have a lot of black Americans in prison now. In 2015, the killings by the cops reminds me of the 1950s and 60s. Well, a lot of that was going on then, and it's going on now. But I believe
it never stopped. It came through slavery, acquired its escape. You know, said don't kill your slaves. Well, they tried not to kill all of us, but certainly there was large killings during slavery. That's
yes, ma'am.
When we got
I believe
the introduction of the so-called nigger stick. Not, of course, it just means nigger was a word that just meant wood in the Irish language. But this is the Irish with the billy club and whatever you want to call it. This is they were the people who were the paddy rollers who came along to control us, replacing the blacks whose job it was to do that. So I've got a lot of blacks that are so negative because we come out of a negative history. But when the Civil War ended, that violence increased. And you can see the images of black males before and after the Civil War. It's amazing. Black males, during slavery, we see him always scratching, bending his head and grinning and looking at the ground and his toes wiggling. Then after slavery, immediately he gets a new image of a razor-toting, mean, with a thirst for white women, raping. This whole imagery, you know, this whole change in what a black male is. Black females also get a change. We are wilder than we used to be. We are wild Jersey Devils now.
Okay.
You know? But the black men are being picked up immediately following slavery. Under contract law, they are pushed into a system of violence that will take them immediately to jail where they get out to serve white folk. You put them in, say you violate your contract, you now got to work for Mr. So-and-so for 30 days. One man and his sons out of Georgia have testimony of as much as 10 years. So yes, violence against blacks to continue to work us for nothing because we didn't have anything when we left slavery. We haven't
dealt with the fact that
we've never been considered human because to be considered human, you're offered land. And the land that we was offered by Lincoln was immediately taken away at his death when President Johnson went in. Lincoln didn't have an executive order giving us land, 40 acres on a mule. That executive order did go through under Lincoln, but Johnson would cancel it immediately. So we've never been attached to land. Natives have land. So they get some respect. But, of course, we live on their land, too.
To me,
the violence against black men and black women is increasing because they're trying to put us back into a state of fear. The Civil Rights Movement took the fear from the grave. You know, in the Bible, they talk about Jesus taking the fear from death. Yes, well, we took the fear from the whole concept of jails. Nobody's scared of no jail. Right. I ain't scared of your jail, the kids say at Birmingham, right? Kids at Jackson say, you know,
fear.
I ain't scared of your jail. Little bitty kids, 5 or 6 years old. Well, now they want to make us afraid, and they figure to make us afraid, they got to force us to bow down, to force us to return back to what we were in and immediately following slavery. People that
yes,
didn't
ma'am.
Have anything
I
were scared to stand up because, you know, you figured you stand up, you get your whole family killed, and you still got nothing.
Okay.
We're going
to
deal with that.
No.
That's our job in the judicial conference on judicial and state violence that's going to be at Princeton will be is designed specifically to bring together all of the major writers and thinkers from all categories and classes of the black America to begin to
yes,
come together to talk about how do we work out this issue. Hopefully we get the people's great attorney Alton Maddox there, because he has been our attorney. He has been beaten and pushed around as if he was a piece of cloth by this judicial system, yet he's fought back gallantly. Fought back, pushing them back. But
yes,
that's happened to black lawyers generally. And so we have to talk about how
lawyers.
We begin to come together to initiate a fight, a struggle to recapture what we lost since 65, right? And at the
yes,
same time, build
right.
new ground because the initial movement was not built on solid ground. Our
yes,
movement
was
never built on solid ground. So we have got to begin to talk about the critical issues, beginning with land, of course, looking at judicial violence, but saying to America, we're going to be respected as human beings, whether you like it or not. That's what we've got to
okay.
do. That's what we're down
I don't
to.
Believe
and we can't play
that.
With that. We've got to organize that, and we've got to respect and appreciate these young people out here, Black Lives Matter, the young group out of Florida. I heard this young man speak up at Duke University a couple of months ago. Powerful brother. These young people out here
yes,
organizing
you're
round
right.
up as we were organizing in the 60s. We've got to respect that. We've got to encourage that. But we've got to provide them with the best possible statistics, the best possible research, the best possible alternatives, and listen to them as they help us shape that.
Yes,
that's our
I understand.
Job.
Everything you're saying, it makes sense. Everything you're saying makes plenty of sense. I was going to say this about the police and the killings. I don't believe it's increased or decreased since segregation. I believe because of the camera phones, the smartphones, people can record, and all the cameras everywhere that's recording pretty much everything, especially if it's done outside. I don't believe the killings have decreased or increased. I think it's just more exposure, internet.
I would agree with you.
Space.
I would agree with you. And we have a press that's being forced to listen. There's a press that's listening. So they have been the major white national press, and it is white, whether we have a lot of black players in it, but it's a corporate press. And, for, you know, they're actually reporting. They're reporting. In the past, they ignored. So I would agree with you that the coming of this new technology and the braveness and the brazenness, actually, of folk who are presenting these videos and sending it out worldwide so that the international community is a part of our everyday affair. Otherwise, it wouldn't mean anything. But because the international community, as was the case with the Vietnam War, when we came out against the Vietnam War and Dr. King took a bold stand, because Malcolm took it in 63, SNCC took it in 63, in fact, Coretta Scott King took it in 63. But Dr. King would not take that bold move until 67. But when that bold move was made, the world saw it. The whole world was looking at it. We was over here actually trying to decapitate and destroy a whole nation called Vietnam, along with Cambodia, Laos, and everything around it. That exposure, with all those things happening at the same time, meant that the government had to deal with us through state action, right? So
yes.
we see state and judicial,
right.
we see the movement of the Congress and whatever,
okay.
To say, yeah, well, we got to give them something.
Yes, ma'am. I was going to say, I was agreeing with you. I also had wanted to ask, I don't know if you were or not, so that's why I'm asking. Were you in Tennessee when the men were killed who worked for the city as sanitation employees?
No, I was not. Dr. King's
okay.
movement, I'm calling it Dr. King's movement, it's moving with the labor unions of Memphis, Tennessee. The garbage workers, the sanitation unions, Dr. King and all the major leadership of the Memphis, Tennessee area. Those are the people where I was not there at all. By now, I have left my first husband, and I'm in New York City, where I will be when I get the word that Dr. King is going. In fact, I would get a phone call from Dr. King's room at 3:30 in the afternoon of his death. And my first husband was trying to put a marriage back together that I was unwilling to put back together.
Yes, sir.
He wanted us to go down. Dr. King was saying, doesn't want to go down to Puerto Rico so we can work that out. But that was not going to be worked out, not by any means.
Yes.
It was a very sad hour. But no, I was not there. That's a great movement. I am a man. The garbage workers of Memphis also saying to the world something we should have all heard, that we should be talking about the upgrading of employee and work functions. We always see
yes.
sanitation workers as being way down at the bottom somewhere, when in fact they should be at the very top of the list, because if they're not cleaning up, then in fact there's no need for us to worry about living, because we're going to have all kinds of diseases. The before care versus the aftercare. And Dr. King was there for that. I was not there for that. And there's a lot of discussion around that. I've read book after book after book about that. And the conclusion has been that the United States government killed Dr. King.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I believe that too.
Yes, ma'am.
But you were referring to the wonderful work of that looks at the 2,000 deaths between 1990 and 1965. I mean, in 1990 and 2000, on just the killing of blacks in the United States by police. More than 2,000 between 90 and 2000. That's one world. And there's no statistics prior to about 1983, when we get the first statistics actually being gathered and kept by federal and state governments. Before then, there's no stats. But you can't count the lynchings in the South. I don't know about the North, but you can't count the lynchings in the South.
Okay. Right.
We know that because when they were dredging the river in 1964 to try to find the bodies of the three young people that had been, that were missing, that would later be found, you know, lynched, the two white males and one black male, the rivers were just loaded with bodies. And then the feds decided to call
that's
it off, and Dr.
Yes.
King and all our leaders let them call that off, rather than saying, pull all these bodies up and let's see what we got. Nothing but bodies. And that was the report from the FBI, that was pulling up nothing but bodies. So that's just one river. Mississippi is loaded with rivers.
Yes.
God knows I could trust the bridge between Mississippi and Arkansas.
It's because of people like you that I'm able to even have the internet show. Women like you and men like you, the civil rights leaders, and just the people who are not, you know, famous, but who also contributed and marched and went through all those horrible things. It's because of you all that I can even have an internet radio show. So I'm going to say thank you. Thank you for what you went through, and thank you for what you did.
Well, thank you for being that young sister. But remember, we are the people, and it's all of the people, even those blacks who thought they weren't in the movement or part of the movement. And at that time, we were still also somewhat of a community. We have lost all that community. So I grew up in a time when all the businesses were in my community. It was a black business, because I was in the colored Negro community. So we had our own little businesses and some big businesses in some cities. But all of that was destroyed with the coming of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. We walked away from our businesses. And in the case of our major industry, which was the entertainment industry, and Mississippi is one of the leading states for that, Stevens Rose Room, the Ballroom, the Blue Room over in Vicksburg, Mississippi, all those went down with the crime syndicate moving in and actually pushing people out, disappearing people and burning places down. So that our base that we had throughout, which was our cultural base that nobody could take from us, until recently, now that we've just given our music away, we've given our art away, we've given our dance and whatever else away. But I grew up in a place where that was solid. In a family that was a musical family. You know, Robert Johnson, the founder of the blues, is cousin. It's a family. Dixon Nairs, Robertson Brothers. So I grew up in a world where people were, the art was all we had, and we could, at least that was ours. Nobody could take our juke joint away. Our do drop in. Nobody could take away our church. because Mississippi is also Lax Carolina, one of the founders of gospel music.
Yes, I have family in Mississippi and Alabama.
Music, you know, and the spiritual, of course, is ours, and it was a way of life. It was our value system came through the spirituals.
Yes,
well,
ma'am.
All that's gone.
Good. Yes, ma'am.
That's gone. So we had a great leadership. We walked away from our base, running after white folks, trying to be what they were, rather than understanding and holding on to the unchanging hand of our ancestors.
Yes, ma'am. I agree with that. Okay, so what I was saying, when you're talking about the levee, when the New Orleans flood came, the state of Louisiana flood came about, some of the people in Mississippi were affected by it. Some of them were my relatives, and they went.
Oh, they're based in St. Louis, the Duckport area. Yeah, probably all the way into Port Gibson. Yeah, anything on that flood zone is affected by it. A lot of Mississippi was affected by it because Mississippi has. Remember seeing articles on, I think it was on Biloxi, quite businessmen who had lost this, that, or the other, and were trying to get set up with government funding. But yeah, no, the South was affected. I mean, the South is affected by every flood. The recent events in Texas, of course, plus that whole,
yes,
affect the whole Gulf Coast.
Yes, ma'am, I understand that. But present day, I know you did great things, wonderful things. You and millions of people like you, but especially you. What I'd like to ask is, in present day, you're still an activist. And also I'd like to ask you, one of the things you've been an activist in is reparations. Now, in present day, 2015, my question is, in your opinion, if reparation does pass one day, what do you believe should reparations do for the black people? Should it be given directly to them? Or, this is hypothetical because it hasn't happened, but if it does happen, what should be done with the money? The reparations, should it go into schools, jobs, or should each family be given money if that ever happens?
Yeah, assuming money reparations. Let's look at the issue of reparations. Of course, I'm saying we need a referendum before reparations because we have never been allowed to gather as a people. That was in violence to us. They treated us like dogs or something after the Civil War. We should have been given a referendum which allowed us to gather as a people, again, talk about where we go from here and how we were going to do that. Now the question of reparations on the table. John Conyers, United States congressman, a former first chair of the Senate, of the Congressional Judiciary Committee, no longer there, but he put the issue of reparations on the table in the U.S. Congress. It should have been around 91. At the same time, Africa was also putting reparations on the table because nobody has considered that we are Africans and that when you talk about reparations, you got to talk about all Africans. And you got to talk about all Africans in the Western world, not just those in the U.S. But let's focus on the U.S. At this point, I think the first reparations piece is to give us our land. Every African in the United States of America has a right to land. Now, how much is an issue because, you know, we're talking about now being what? 100 years plus, 150 years plus from where? From 1865. All right?
Yeah,
so we now have to begin to talk about where from here in terms of reparations, in terms of land, which gives us a grounding. So reparations has to first be the structural piece that says we have a right to come together as a group. We are a national people. A nation unto ourselves. We have been defined by government reports and everything else over and over again. So as a nation, we should have a right to land that allows us to gather in a similar zone, a closely connected zone, on land that we own. That's the first piece. That should be sponsored by the government. Now, the piece that everybody always jumps at is the individual piece. What does the individual piece look like? Can I get me some dollars? Well, I think that's a fair call. You will give right to some dollars. But the government should be giving us money for education anyway. We shouldn't pay for that. That should not come out of your reparations dollars. Education, push forward through the U.S. Congress, Reconstruction Congress, with black leadership from Mississippi and South Carolina, that is a piece for all Americans. Why is it when it comes to black folk, all of a sudden everything loses its color? All of the violence of the Civil Rights Act of 64, all we went through, that is a bland peace for everybody. Nothing to do with just black people. Even though we were what? We were the victims. We were the warriors who fought the fight. We got the crumbs from the table. So education should be paid for by the United States government, state governments, and local governments, as it should be. So yes, education is not on the table. Now, if we want to create our own schools with the money we get, that is up to us. But it's not a part of a reparations discussion. That applies for housing. That applies for basic stuff that's there, including jobs. Reparation is not the replacement for money for your job you didn't get. You have a right to a job, so we should put forth Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights that says there should be full employment for everybody, guaranteed annual income. That didn't come from black folks. That came from President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who didn't get a chance. First of all, it went down before he died, but even if he wanted to push it, he didn't get a chance to even think about it because he was gone immediately from a strange heart attack. So we need to understand that reparations, in terms of funds, if we want some individual money, people have a right to that. But we cannot disconnect that from Africa. We cannot disconnect that from the fact that our humanity itself is gone. So you and I don't run around speaking an African language, and there are more than 2,000 of them. We run around speaking English. Or trying to speak English, right?
Because so all slavery, of this, we only have our native tongue, our native language.
We have nothing. We don't have our religion. We don't have our native value system. It's being pulled and torn apart, so we're killing each other and doing things we would not ordinarily do in Africa and here. Because the Western imperialism is destroying us on both shores, on all shores, all the way to Australia. And that's how far we stretch. All right? So we need to begin to, with reparations, talk about, yes, it should be the monetary value. What people do with their money, we shouldn't be arguing about that. We should be arguing about making sure that the structural pieces that allowed us to build ourselves as a nation is in place and that we are allowed to begin to talk about going home to Africa for those who want to return and that Africa be given reparations for having removed us, one-third of its population, in a strange world, while it's being warred on, we're being warred on Brazil, which is another the big mainland state. We need to look at that because they traded us back and forth here through the islands of Brazil, Central and South America, more than 10 million blacks in Mexico as in 2005. So we need to look at that and know, say, we want one solid peace, but we want to sit down at the table and talk about what that looks like as a people and symposium, like the symposium at Princeton, it's where we began those discussions, tiny town, so that we can refine it. And refine it not as black Europeans, but as black Africans.
Yes,
that's what we are. And honor to Haiti. Respect to Haiti. And a demand that Haiti's reparations from France and more than $20 billion be given immediately. And that America's reparations to Haiti, which has not had a value placed on it yet.
Yes, yes.
No value for the first democratic republic on planet Earth, Haiti. And yet we hardly know it's there. Hardly know it's there. So that's a part of a reparations discussion.
Yes, part of reparations. Okay, thank you for answering that. So in about 2 or 3 minutes, I'm going to open the phone lines up to see if anyone has any questions for Ms. Clark. I got one or two more questions. In the continent Africa, Algeria, could you explain why you're active with Algeria and what's going on in that over in the continent Africa?
Oh, that's a big discussion.
Okay.
I'm lightly involved with Africa, not as heavy as I should be. As we all should be. I was invited to Algeria it's my first trip in 2005 to speak for its parliament on the discussion of the devolution and devastation of Africans everywhere. Africans in Africa and Africans in the diaspora. I was one of 5 speakers. The others came from various African states. So that's where it began. Now, how did I get there? I got there because a friend of mine had taken me to invited me to a conference in Madrid, Spain. And while I was there, I got to meet people and meeting people and people hearing my discussion about what was happening in the U.S. And this was a trade union conference, the International Labor Organization. So hearing that, Louisa Hanon, who is for me the most phenomenal woman on planet Earth, who is in the parliament in Algeria, who also is the woman who organized the women's struggles in Lebanon, Palestine, Tunisia, and the rest of North Africa. So the women are in those areas serving in legislatures and whatever. It came as a result of her being a part of the Algerian liberation movement. She was raped and abused and molested, got away to Tunisia, and from there was able to work her way in, you know, in building a career in lifting women up. So that's how I was invited, and that's why I was there in Algeria. And since my invite there, I was asked that question similar to what you asked. How shall I put it? There was obviously a person in the room whose job it was to upstage anything that I had to say. They thought I was going to be talking about Malcolm X. Well, I was not a part of the Malcolm X movement, though I admired the man and his work. So I wasn't talking about Malcolm X. I was talking about the Boy Civil Rights Movement and what was happening in the U.S. and also the modern time period, though Malcolm and King and all will come to this time period because they are the forebears who will shape it, yet we're in a new time period. So obviously that's not going to be my discussion. But there was a person in the audience who screamed out. He said, well, what about all these blacks coming back to Africa? We don't want you back in Africa. Da, 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 da. And so I said, I'm going to be dethroned if I make the wrong move. So I let him talk. Yes. And when he was through, I answered him by saying, sir, I'm not knowledgeable of a great back to Africa movement in the U.S. at this time. But I want to tell you, when we left, we did not leave any quit claim deeds to keep the gates open. And the whole audience went wild. So from that moment forward, I have a space in Africa. And I'm very grateful to have it. Keep the gates open, Africa, because we are Africans and we will be home someday.
Okay. I have to say some of the information I have got, I'm going to name a couple of references that I got some information from on Ms. Claudia Lafayette Clark. I want to talk about Wikipedia, and I got some of the information there. I also got information about you from the organizer, Anthony Palmer, wrote things about you and interviewed you. So that's where I got a lot of my information from, and those are my resources. I just have another question. So you explained what you believe reparations should be about, but now I'm going to go back to the past. I'd like to know if Ms. Rosa Parks was the first black person or black female to refuse to give up her seat in Montgomery, Alabama.
Of course she was not. She was the last of more than 200 women and men who took seats, mostly women, on the bus. She is a part of a classic piece, and I like to talk about it takes 9 months to have a baby. March the 2nd, 1955, a young girl, Claudette Colburn, got on a bus right in front of Dr. King's Ebenezer there, right in front of the church. She got on the bus. And when she got on the bus, she was, of course, asked to get up out of her seat. She refused to give it up. And Claudette is available. You should interview her sometime. So she refused to give up her seat. And in refusing to give up her seat, was drugged from the bus, this juvenile, 15 years old. And the 15-year-old girls are dangerous. She was drugged from the bus. Of course, she sent one police officer to the hospital, and the other one took her to juvenile hall. So it was not a pleasant dragon, and obviously she was not terribly brutalized, but brutalized to get her into juvenile halls. She was a resistant teen. But she is the only person, more than 200 people sit on the bus in Montgomery. She's the only person to plead not guilty to violating segregation's laws, and her words, I paid my 20 cents, and I got a ride as an American citizen, right, as an American citizen, to ride on the bus where I please. Now, that was March the 2nd. Seven months later, in October, and I never forget the date, I think it was 16th, another young girl, a 16-year-old named Mary Louise Smith, who is still alive, both women are still alive, and Mary Louise is available for interviews. Mary Louise will also desegregate the wives in the state of Alabama. Mary Louise refused to give up her seat, and she went to jail. But, of course, when she came into court in the juvenile hall, she pleaded guilty to violating segregation laws. And then December 1 of 55, Rosa Parks takes a seat. Now, what's interesting about this is that Rosa Parks had been the advisor to the youth council that both of these young, in the youth council that both of these young women had been in. It's a very interesting phenomenon. But when Rosa Parks took that seat, she had also been a revolutionary. She had been struggling in Alabama for years along with E.D. Nixon from the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, who was the person who formed NAACP in Montgomery, Alabama, who fought lynchings and everything else, and she fought with him. Rosa Parks had done that. Rosa Parks was not new to struggle. But when she took a seat, the Women's Political Organization, which had been trying to get a lawsuit off the ground, moved on it, and they pushed and they got immediately. That's why they were up all night long, run off 40,000 leaflets to make sure everybody in the area, black and area, had a leaflet, a flyer. They were able to get a bus boycott. They had the mass meetings with Claudette Colvin. I'm not sure if there was any mass meeting at all when Mary Louise took a seat, but I'm sure that must have been at least one or two. But Rosa Parks got everything. She got everything because she was an older woman who had been out here as a warrior for a long time and was able to pull off the initiation, the impetus for initiation of a major boycott in Montgomery. But it's not the boycott that got us the end of the, got us the desegregation of the bus. It's actually the lawsuit. So you'll see Dr. King talking about the lawsuit, standing there saying, I think we ought to call off the lawsuit, the court has blah, blah, blah. And that lawsuit, Claudette Colvin, Mary Louise Smith, in the name of Amelia Browder, and Susan McDonald, who was 72 years old, couldn't distinguish her from white, but had defended and fought off a lynch mob. She was a bad Mojana. In 1919, she actually put some white folks on a plank road down in the mud to free a black brother from a lynching scene. So these were the people, the four people that were on the lawsuit. And there's wonderful curriculum piece that's there on the Montgomery 55 piece. And if you can, you should pick it up. It's a really wonderful curriculum piece. Deals with the lawsuit itself. And in doing so we'll deal with the history of the Montgomery movement. But Rosa Parks is a major. We should see her for that, what she is. But we must also reclaim these two young women. They're both with us. We need to make sure that the world knows about Claudette Colvin, because I wasn't looking at Rosa Parks. I was looking at what? I was 15 in Mississippi. I was looking at Claudette Colvin. I was screaming about the death of Emmett Till in 55. But Claudette Colvin will be the spark in my life that will start me to organize in youth in Jackson, Mississippi.
Yes,
you understand what I'm saying? So when you look at that and understand that Rosa has to have a place, cannot deny you access to what it has done to create major struggle. And that's the same as true for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the four young men who took a seat over in Greensboro, North Carolina. They got some little statue over there in Greensboro. Why they don't have a national monument to our young people who actually built the civil rights movement of the 60s going forward? No, you didn't really get me started. Now, I don't think you're going to get me started.
Yes, ma'am. Ms. Clark, I'd like to know, what do you think of President Obama and the First Lady, Ms. Michelle Obama, who are in Washington, D.C., is at the White House? I mean, what do you feel about that?
First, I guess it has to be first. Let me just say they are first, but on the other hand, I look critically at people, and I think it would be unfair to question myself probably this evening to tackle the issue of Barack Obama, who promised us no war, and we got nothing but war standing on the brink now of World War. Barack Obama, who has absolutely turned his back, as far as I'm concerned, on black people in the United States, so that the whole move, the thrust toward mass employment versus mass unemployment, welfare, police state, where we've been killed night and day, that the president can play a great role in that, and that he has not moved to pressure the state of Pennsylvania to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. He has not moved to pressure the state of Pennsylvania to free other political prisoners and other prisoners, Leonard Peltier, all these people who were there, who have been there. Leonard Peltier, I believe, is a federal prisoner. H. Rap Brown, who now operates out of this Muslim name, Jamil Alameen. These people are there in jail rotting, and they are great leaders. The leader for our black communities are locked away. Obama hasn't dealt with that. And his insult to Africa is unacceptable, just unacceptable. We have 28 military bases in Africa. The destruction of Muammar, and in fact, the crucifixion of Muammar Gaddafi, and the destruction of the move of Africa toward a strong, goal-based political economy.
Yes,
those things I would hold them to task on. I hold them to task for Iraq, because he could have gone, we have no business there, and he could have gotten us out of there. I hold them to task for Afghanistan with mass murder every day. We have to be clear that we can't just talk about what white presidents do and don't do. We have to be the same when one of ours goes to the presidency. Now I want to be very clear too to you that I don't consider Barack Obama to be just black. I think he's that we got to accept he got a white mama. And I honor that sister. She's done a great job in developing a fine man, a great mind, and we can't just insult her and pretend that's not her son. He was socialized white in the white world. Now, he may want to be a part of us, but his actions demonstrate that he's not. Now, Michelle Obama's a wonderful woman. I hope she keeps on growing. I was thinking if she would run for president, she probably would be a phenomenal president. A wonderful sister.
Yes, sir. She would be greatest president. Okay. So I'm going to open the phone lines up.
The floodgates are opening.
All right. You have a nice voice. Area code 917, do you have anything to ask Ms. Clark?
No, this is Reggie Peavy in New York, and I just have a quick comment, and that's about it. Except both of y'all were both great tonight, and I enjoyed everything that you had to offer, and thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Peavy. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Just waiting on that conference call for that Princeton University Judicial
September the 5th, 12 noon.
Yes. I want everyone on that call with us and stuff so we can take care of business.
Yes, we've got big business to take care of.
Yes,
that's the conference on judicial and state violence that I spoke of earlier. Well, we're really talking about bringing together the minds to begin to work out a strong organizational plan, coming away from there with a base that will be so strong that we can demand those reparations. And when we get those reparations, be able to utilize them in a way that's beneficial to the building of us as a people, not to a few people with some money in the pocket.
I was just going to say that the blackout, according to the internet and radio stations, they had 12.1 billion, I think, or 1 million that they had made. I'm not sure if it was a million, but I think it was 1.5 or 1.6 billion, please correct me if I'm wrong, that cost during the blackout for the first 2 days of the blackout, $1.6 or $1.7 billion. That's what I wanted to say.
That seems like it's a small amount for the internet.
Now,
that'd be my comment.
That's good.
That is international. That's a major source. And by the way, we need to tell people that this piece was spawned by an African brother and a brother out of New Orleans in terms of talking about this new internet piece.
Yes,
the operation, yes, we have nothing to do with it when Africa has everything to do with it.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. All right. So is there anybody else with any questions for Ms. Clark? The phone lines are open. Nobody's muted. Okay. I guess not. Okay. Well, Ms. Clark and Mr. Reggie, thank you both for coming on Show Talk with Angela Butler. I've learned a lot, and I'm just grateful that that you did what you did. And millions of people who were not, you know, who are not, who's nameless, I thank them too.
Okay, so I'm going to end the show, Show Talk with Angela Butler. Ms. Clark, thank you for coming on Show Talk.
Melinda, let me just say how proud I am to know that there's a young woman in Florida who's lifting us up, lifting our voices up, getting out accurate information, helping to get it out in a way which people can utilize it to build a base. And so thank you so much, sister. I'm very proud of you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Ms. Clark. It's an honor for me, too. All right. Everyone have a good night. Thank you for calling in. For those of you who would like to listen to this show again, it should be available within an hour. It may take longer. It depends on how many other shows are on this website network. Thank you all. And again, thank you, Mr. Keating, and thank you, Ms. Clark. And thank you all for
thank
calling.
Thank you very much, darling.
Thank
you, Ms. Phoebe.
Are you welcome?
Ma'am.
I said thank you, Ms. Phoebe, and good night, everybody. Good night, Florida. Good night,
Florida. Okay. All right. Thank you. All right, everyone. Those of you who are listening from the Internet, who normally listen to Show Talk with Angela Butler, we had Ms. Colga Lafayette-Clark on Show Talk with Angela Butler. She's a civil rights activist, and those of you who would like to go back and listen to her, you can do so easily by going to my Facebook page or going to Blog Talk Radio Show and type in Show Talk with Angela Butler. You can go to Google Share Plus, LinkedIn, any of those places, because that's where the show's links are. But for those of you who usually already listen, well, you know the routine. If you have anything to say about this interview, just message me on Facebook. Everybody have a good night.